This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm Ned Smith, Director of the Aquarium. Welcome to another Meet the Scientist lecture. This is something we do periodically through the year, and if you are not a member, you can find out about these things in our newsletter on board. And perhaps in other ways. We're glad to have you all here today. This is your opportunity to find out what one of our scientists has been up to over the past months, weeks, years, and sometimes even decades. Today's speaker is Dr. Nicholas Holland. Dr. Holland got his undergraduate degree at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota in 1960, and from there went to Stanford University, where he got his Ph.D., and his thesis was in the area of the physiology of sea urchins, those spiny things that you may have seen in our tide pools. Excuse me. He then received an NSF postdoctoral award and worked at the worked at the Stazione Zoologica di Napoli, which is, of course, in Naples, Italy, for 2 years. Then in 1966, took a job on the faculty here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and has been here ever since, with the exception, of course, of traveling extensively in the Caribbean, Japan, Australia, Scandinavia, England, and France. So not all bad in the traveling department in terms of destinations. His talk today is entitled, Who Was the Ancestor of the Vertebrates? Please welcome Dr. Nicholas Holland.
Thank you for the introduction. The applause reminds me that applause at the beginning of a talk is faith, and applause in the middle is hope, and applause at the end is charity. So today I am going to talk about this subject, but not as much as you think. So here's a menu of what I want to cover today. Since this is a Meet the Scientist series, the focus should, I suppose, be on me, which my mother would not approve of. She always told me that was bad form. I've never actually done this before, so it'll be interesting. I do basic research, not applied research, and so I wanted to just propagandize you a little about why it's a good thing to do and why you should continue paying your taxes to support people like me. And then I want to go over my path to becoming a marine biologist, which is a very personal thing, and then focus on my research and talk a little bit about my youthful enthusiasm for eggshells. And then one of the points of this is how unexpectedly in science sometimes you suddenly find yourself doing something quite different. And then I want to go on to a famous paternity suit, which is who was the ancestor of the vertebrates. And that involves some molecular biology, which I'm going to spare you the details of, some anatomy and fossils, and then reach some sort of conclusion. So let me start out then with why do basic science? Well, there's basic science and there's applied science, and there's no hard line in between them. I mean, Marconi was very interested to know whether radio waves went straight out and missed something distant because they never bent with the curvature of the Earth. But he suspected that they did, and he founded his company, the Marconi Wireless Company, before he even did the experiment. So you can do both at once. Believe me. Why do basic science? Well, one of the best examples of why I do it is somebody you may not have heard of named Friedrich Miescher, who was Swiss and lived in the last century, and he discovered DNA and isolated it and partly characterized it in 1869, 71, along in there. And he never once said why he did it. He was simply interested in what sorts of things do you find in the nucleus of cells. And, of course, this is the foundation and the beginning of all the biotechnology and all the health-related things that DNA is so important for now. So it's simply that you can't do applied research if people don't do basic research first. It just doesn't work. It's as simple as that. All right, how did I get into marine biology? Marine biology is the important word here. And I hope you don't think I'm being facetious with the next slide, because this is a very important slide. This is 60 years ago, and you know it's me because I still have the dimple. This is Gulf weed. That's the Atlantic coast. This is Sargasso weed from the Sargasso Sea. And these are Australian pine trees in the back, and there's just a couple of dozen houses. This is north of Fort Lauderdale before World War II. And my father had bought this beach for a couple of $1,000s after the land crash in 1929 in Florida. And if he'd held on to it and not sold it 55 years ago for very little, I wouldn't be talking to you now because I'd be one of the idle rich. At any rate, I grew up here, and I like the environment, evidently. What you don't see on the beach is shells. In those days, there were no tourists. When I was 5 or 6, I began collecting seashells. And then when I was 7 or 8, I started taking them to the public library and matching them with the pictures in the shell book. So I knew all the scientific names of all the shells of eastern Florida by the time I was 10. And I really liked it. But one thing led to another, and here I am only 40 years ago, and I'm in the middle of the Midwest. It's snowing outside, and I'm in a room with a bunch of mice, and I'm not smiling. There's no dimple, because I was finding out a bunch of things about myself. One was I didn't like the snow, and the second was I didn't like mice, and I was very unhappy because I was a long way from the ocean. So to make a long story short, I arranged to become a marine biologist at that point and got my first job at Scripps. So here I am on one of the Scripps ships. What I do for a living at Scripps is I teach oceanography to undergraduates, and I teach invertebrate zoology to graduate students and pick up and do a few seminars at other times, and the rest is pretty much research. So now, I want to go from my original interest in seashells to an interest in eggshells, which happened to me after I got to graduate school. And this is a cover of a book, but it's about echinoderms. And this is a starfish, and it has 5 arms. And just as the starfish has 5 arms, the echinoderms have 5 major groups. And these are just little icons, but this is obviously a starfish. This is a sea urchin. This is a sea cucumber, and this is an ophiuroid. And this one that you probably don't recognize is a crinoid echinoderm. And I got very interested in the eggshells of crinoid echinoderms, as you'll see in a little while. But first, I want to talk about what crinoids are. There's really 2 major body plans in crinoids. The first one is what we call a sea lily. I've knocked the number of arms down to 5 per animal here because I can't draw very well. There can be up to 200, but what you see here is sort of a body with a mouth and these arms that stick out with side branches, and then there's a big stalk. That's a sea lily. It looks like a lily. The other major kind is called a feather star, and it's exactly the same as the sea lily above this point, but below that point, instead of one single stalk, it has a whole lot of little grabbers. Another word for a feather star would be sea fern, which I like even better, but feather star is one of the words. Sea lilies are probably the crinoid that most of you have seen. If you go to a museum, sea lilies make great fossils. And in the Paleozoic times, they were probably the most important benthic invertebrate in terms of making sediments. I'm sure a geologist that knew a lot more than I do would say that's not exactly totally true. But the Atlas Mountains in North Africa are made out of crinoids. And if you walk around in Indiana or Ohio, you're walking on crinoids the whole time. That just limestone is just made out of crinoids. So here you see the stalk and the top part that looks like a little palm tree. These guys were incredibly common then. And for some reason, they became rather rare later. And so sea lilies now are limited to the deep sea, and there are not very many species. And I've only twice in my life seen a living sea lily. They're beautiful. I mean, this is taken by a submersible, and there's the long stalk and the palm tree at the top. But they're not practical. They're hard to work on. So I like to work on feather stars. Feather stars, here's one with lots. That's one animal with lots of arms. Live in nice places, for starters. They live in the French Riviera, and they live on the Great Barrier Reef, and they live in terrible places like that. So I got interested in them immediately. And so here's one large animal. And one of the feather stars I started studying was in Japan, near Tokyo. This is really Sagami Bay, which is just south of Tokyo Bay. And this is a very old marine station called the Misaki Marine Biological Laboratory. And in fact, if you look out the window, what you see is Mount Fuji across Sagami Bay. If this is the smog from Tokyo. It probably looks familiar to you. If it's not too bad, you can just barely see the mountain. At any rate, why did I go to Japan? I found this old table of numbers here once, and I needed an animal that might be, you might sharpen that up, yeah. I needed an animal that would spawn eggs for me, because it's funny, if you take a sea urchin and hit it with a brick or something, or you're nicer and electroshock it or do something like that, you can always get eggs out of it that you can fertilize anytime, practically. But with crinoids, you have to get eggs that the females have spawned naturally or nothing happens. So here was an animal that spawned once a year. All the animals spawned in the bay. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the day of the quarter moon in October, it was pretty amazing. It was like a sea calendar. It wasn't perfect. Here's the date, 13th of October. They actually did it on the 12th, 15th. They did it on the 14th. And people had watched this since before World War II and right through the middle of the war. And they didn't always spawn. That was the scary part of going all the way to Japan. Some years they just sulked, but most of the time they spawned. So all you had to do was look at your moon calendar and decide when to go. And what you got, here's the day before spawning. And this is a kind of a blah-colored brownish crinoid, but there's the central body, and it has all these arms, 40 arms going out. And these side branches on the arms are called pinials, and the gonads are in the pinials. That's why they look so fat. And if you break one open, you get thousands of neat little eggs popping out. And anyway, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they'd spawn. I had 2 hours a year to work because the eggs died after 2 hours. So I did all my experiments within a two-hour period. And so I did something wrong every year, and I had to go back and back. So for 6 years, I studied them. One of the interesting things about them, though, was the eggs looked smooth. Think of this as being an entirely smooth egg at the beginning. This is 16 minutes after spawning and 1 minute after I added sperm. And the fertilizing sperm actually hit it at the top, and this is the eggshell. It's being made in a wave-like pattern. And it's coming up in this wonderful little sort of tripe or beehive pattern, and very fancy. And in fact, by 3 minutes later, if you look at it, here's the egg inside its shell, and the shell's all covered with spines. Well, they're really ridges that intersect into hexagons. Well, this was like origami. It just happened in front of your eyes, and it took me 6 years to figure out how it happened. It was non-trivial, it turned out. I had to use a lot of different techniques and remove various layers and drug them with this and do surgery. You don't have to memorize this, but the story is very complicated. And the immature eggs, at a certain point, begin to get dents in them that look like this. So the whole thing looks like a golf ball with those little dents in it. Each dent fills up with a glob of jelly. Then on the day of spawning, the whole thing goes smooth again. The jelly stays where it was. And this is a template, this dent, for where the jelly is. And a new membrane is made, and then there are these little granules here that have a role. When you add the sperm, these granules pop out and accumulate under the blue membrane, which elevates where the jelly isn't. Well, I don't want to go into that too deeply, but you can see it kept me busy for a long time. But I was interested in other eggshells of other animals, too. And here's an example of, this is just part of the animal kingdom. You don't have to worry about these huge names, but one of the big branches of the animal kingdom, if this is the tree of animal life, if you break it off, is this group here that includes echinoderms, which I'd been working on, and acorn worms, which I worked on in Hawaii, and tunicates, which I didn't bother with because other people played around with them, and vertebrates, other people played around with them. But one of the groups that had been ignored for eggshells was Amphioxus, which is a famous animal. It's a cephalochordate. So from here over, these are all chordates, very closely related to vertebrates. And these are urochordates, cephalochordates, and vertebrates. And that's all together called the chordates. At any rate, this animal began to interest me because of the eggshell problem. Completely, it wasn't understood, because getting Amphioxus to spawn in any way was a big technical problem. And I'll just show you what the animal looks like. It looks like very little, actually. It looks like an anchovy that is all bleached out with no eyes. It just has this sort of fillet pattern down it of muscular segments. But if you look at it schematically, it says I'm very closely related to vertebrates, because it has a nerve cord that's hollow, the blue thing on the dorsal side. I've taken away most of the meat here, but it has these segments of muscle all down the body like a little fish. It has gill slits, just like a fish. And it has this notochord in yellow, which is a compression strut kind of like this that underlies, that has the muscles on either side of it. And so that strut can do this. It's very firm. And you can see, if you didn't have it and you contracted the muscles, the animal would accordion down. It would get shorter and longer, but you don't want it to do that. You want it to wiggle in an eel-like way to swim. At any rate, those are some main things that make it resemble a vertebrate. So it turns out, by every measure, this is the closest living invertebrate and relative that the vertebrates have today. And that's why it interested me. And the problem was, first of all, finding the dang things. They live all over the world, but not in large numbers in most places. There are very few hot spots, and some of them are in rather odd, out-of-the-way places like Lagos, Nigeria, or Spanish Sahara, places where it would be difficult to get them probably, and you wouldn't have a good lab. But in this country, the best place to get them is in Tampa Bay on the west coast of Florida. And this is a very big bay. If you look at Florida from a spaceship, it looks as if somebody took a bite out of the west coast. And the animals are very common there. 70% of the biomass, infaunal, the stuff that lives under the sand in parts of the bay, is Amphioxus. And you literally can get dozens in a shovelful when you're lucky. Here's what they look like at home. This is not Amphioxus. That's a stingray, which I've studied the ecology of these animals too, because they interested me so much. This is the major predator. But here's the way you live if you're an Amphioxus. You burrow down into the sand, and you just leave your snoot sticking out, and you filter little bugs out of the water. You catch, they're very mild-mannered. They don't go around eating big stuff. They eat little tiny particles. And at night, they can swim around. You'd never see this during the day. This is just an artist's concept of, you know, so you can see what the whole body looks like. But here's their little fins, and they have little whiskers up front, and then they very obvious striping due to the muscular segmentation. They're convenient because they live in shallow water, and here I am with my wife, Linda, who works with me, and she's also on the staff at Scripps, collecting Amphioxus, and it's very easy. You just have a window screen in the bottom of a box, and you shovel in a little sand and shake the sand. Sand falls through, and the Amphioxus are hopping around in there, and then you put them in a dishpan. So this is what one female looks like. The most obvious thing you see here is these little yellow ovaries that run off. They're about 25 on each side, so 50. These are full of eggs, and you can see right through the animals. They're like glass. So you can say, that's a girl. The boys have white testes. And so you take them in the lab, and we discovered, my wife and I were the first people to figure this out, and that's why it was kind of a breakthrough. If you give a mild electric shock to these animals, they'll spawn. So you go to Kmart and you buy all these little special Amphioxus aquariums in stacks, and you put an electrode on them, and this is a little muscle stimulator, and that doesn't kill them or hurt them, actually. They just sort of jump a little, and then the eggs come out. And so that's what we did, and it was the first time, as I said, people had been able to do this. Before, I don't suppose they'd bred Amphioxus more than a dozen times in the history of biology, and now we're able to do it most evenings, okay? So it changed a lot. It became much more convenient to do this. And I don't want to go into this too deeply, but here are the funny granules. This is the edge of an unfertilized egg, and here's some extracellular stuff. And when the sperm hits it, these granules actually explode and catch on the inside of that. And it wasn't a pretty membrane. It was very smooth, but at least we did it. And then the next day, the membrane, the eggshell, would have been sort of from here to here, and then this guy would have hatched out. But this is what we ended up with the next day. It was about 10 or 16. We had these wonderful little embryos swimming around. Just to review what's going on here, this is 100 microns is a tenth of a millimeter. So you have to put a whole bunch of these in a row even to make a millimeter, about 8 of them. These eggs, once they're fertilized, are dividing. This is the time after fertilization. Very rapidly, you get a ball of cells, and then one side caves in. You get what you call a gastrula. And then very suddenly, right along in here, you suddenly get all the features of a vertebrate. You got a nerve cord and a notochord, and I could never go into that in 1 hour. But the fact was, here we were, and I thought it would be a crying shame to throw these embryos away. I said, we've done the eggshell, but why don't we think of something to do with these embryos, since now we're the first people that can do this. And I thought, we have to have something that we can sell the NSF on. So I said, well, let's do molecular genetics. It really was kind of like that. So here we're going to shift. This is just another parable about how science is really done. We're going to shift completely away from eggshells to developmental genetics, which is certainly not the sort of thing you want to deal with a general audience. I mean, it is a very special field with its own jargon. And so it's okay to talk about it among consenting adults, but I'm not going to go deeply into it today. I will say that they'd long known that there were some genes that were pretty powerful. They were sort of master genes in the body, or blueprint genes, whatever you want to call it. So here's a normal head of a fruit fly with a little, this is the thing they dip in your sugar, you know, when they get on the table. The proboscis. Well, if something goes screwy with just one gene, you get legs sticking out there, and it's called the proboscipedia mutation. Well, they'd known about that for a long time, but the genetic basis of it became obvious 20 years ago, and I don't want to go into this, but I'll say one of the bombshells of 20th century zoology was the discovery that the developmental genes from flies to mice all through the animal kingdom were very, very much the same from one animal to the next. Not at all expected. So in structure, you can read across the gene in bases or read across the protein the gene makes in amino acids, and they look almost the same. And it's been half a billion years since these two things have been separate. So you can't change these very important genes around very much without killing the animal, probably. That's probably the reason. And it's very constrained. There's another thing, though, that the places where the genes are turned on in the animals tend to be the same from one animal to the next. So here's a fly baby. This is a grown-up fly. And this is a mouse baby. But generally, the red gene here is very similar to that gene and the blue gene, so on. So even the spatial relations are very similar. And this conservation is quite striking. When I say a gene is turned on, I mean that the gene is making messenger RNA, or an RNA message, and the RNA will then make a protein that has some function. Well, you can tell by doing certain witchcraft on your baby animals, or your grown-up animals, as the case may be, where in the animal is a given gene turned on. In other words, we're turning the gene, the region where the gene is turned on is now blue, where it's not turned on is just plain. And this is a baby Amphioxus about the next morning. After, you know, this is a 12-hour animal. It's going my direction. That's its snout. And this I just picked this at random. This is the gene called PAX6, which is a famous gene because it's the master gene that controls the eye. It's really, wherever you see an eye in any animal, the first thing that turns on is this funny gene, PAX6. And indeed, the Amphioxus eyes are turning on, as is this thing, and that's the anterior pituitary. And one of the side jobs of PAX6 is to turn on the anterior pituitary. And in fact, the front end, which is equivalent to your olfactory or nasal epithelium, is turning on, again, just as it would in a mouse. And in fact, there are even some fruit fly receptors that they think are chemoreceptors that do this. I just want you to know, technically, this is the sort of thing that we deal with. We take our baby animals. First, we get the genes out. I don't want to tell you how to do that. It's very boring. And then we characterize them. It's a lot of work. And then when we have that, we can make a reverse sense probe that will go in and recognize the messages and turn blue. At any rate, that's the end of the molecular genetics. Here's the logic. Amphioxus, as I said, is the closest living invertebrate relative of the vertebrates, and it seems likely that both groups were derived from a common ancestor. In other words, Amphioxus is not our ancestor. Amphioxus is not its own ancestor. In a way, it's our great uncle, not our grandfather. There is something kind of like Amphioxus in a famous Canadian fossil named Pikea. I'll show you a picture of. Is kind of like Amphioxus. At any rate, as such, you can kind of use Amphioxus as a stand-in for the ancestor of the vertebrates. And this is fraught with difficulties because in 500 million years, you can lose a lot and gain a lot independently, but it's the only game in town, and the question is your cup half empty, is your cup half full? So we look at it, of course, as our cup is half full. And the last thing is you can kind of get insights into important evolutionary questions by looking at these genetics. And the question that interested us most at the beginning was, what sort of nervous system, what sort of brain did the ancestor of the vertebrates have? This has long been a very contentious issue. And so there were three schools of thought. There was the no-brain school, like we're descended from completely brainless invertebrates that just kind of had a spinal cord with no brain at the end of it. There's the little brain school that says, well, there was a teeny-weeny brain up there. And then there was the big brain school that said there was a big brain up there. And so no progress. This was just an argument that there were no data to address the argument with. What our approach was to get genes that were very important in the vertebrate brain. And here we have the forebrain, the midbrain, and the hindbrain here. These numbers are in the hindbrain. This gene, I won't even bother you with what it is, is marking the middle of the hindbrain. And so in the amphioxus, you're getting a pattern like this. And so as a first approximation, you could say, well, that's the middle of the hindbrain, maybe. You can do another gene, and this one stripes just in front of the yellow gene. Again, we're getting the same pattern. So just to make a long story short, you can map this nervous system using genes that are similar to those of the vertebrate. And the take-home message was that there's really a forebrain and a midbrain and a hindbrain in Amphioxus that's pretty big. Now, up in Canada, at the same time, somebody was doing a completely different thing with Amphioxus that was very labor-intensive, but attacking the same question. And that was a guy named Thurston Lacolly had gotten some baby amphioxuses, and here you see the nervous system. This is the notochord, the striped thing. Overlying it is this tubular nervous system. And up front is an eye-like pigmented spot, and then here's another actual photoreceptor organ. What he was doing was sectioning this slowly from the front end, but for electron microscopy. And he had just a very few animals, and it took him 5 years to do this, but because each section is incredibly thin. And he saved each section, and they looked like, if we went about to this level and looked at that brain, the electron micrograph you could focus that a little. This is the neural canal, and this is the edge of the neural tube, and these are neurons. And he drew each one of these, or we say digitized it, into a computer for each section. That's why it took 5 years. And when he was all through, he took all these data and he pushed the button. And what you can do then is build up a three-dimensional image from all these two-dimensional images. And you get all the wiring diagram of the brain. This is just the first few cells up front, but he filled in back. And you can ask the computer to turn this around so you can look at it from there or look at it. So very powerful technique. Again, I won't bore you with the details. But what he found was, if you look at just structure, not genes, he found the same thing we found with the genes. That is that here's the forebrain of the diencephalon, and there are structures here that are similar to there. And similarly, these colored structures, like the epiphysis, which is your epiphysis, is equivalent to something called the lamellar body, and the the tectum region for the where the input for the visual system goes is similar. So basically it was forebrain, midbrain, and then hindbrain. So that those were two approaches. And when you have two approaches that both kind of point to the same thing, you feel a lot better because they're totally independent. Well, now the next approach that shows up is the paleontological end of things. And here again, the parable I'm telling today is you never know what's going to happen in science. And the reason that this was such a funny story or odd story was this guy here, who's sitting on a hill in South China with probably the greatest Chinese paleontologist that's out there ever, was a student at Scripps, and I was one of his committee members. He worked on diatoms 20 years ago for Dr. Volcani at Scripps. And I worked very closely with Chao-Wai Li, who's this guy. And about 2 years ago, he walked into my office, and I hadn't seen him in 15 years. And he said, guess what I'm doing now? I'm a paleontologist. So he's been working on some very remarkable and very ancient fossils from South China with his colleague, J.Y. Chen, here. And in fact, this is the fossil bed. That's a very characteristic shale that they're working with. Here's just a little timeline so that you'll know where we are. The most recent era was sort of the age of mammals, and then the era in the middle, which is you could call pretty old, is the age of reptiles. So Jurassic Park is up here, right? Then you begin dropping really far back. And it's been very interesting to people to try to think of or try to find an animal that they could say, well, this must have been related to the, at least related to the ancestor of the vertebrates. And the game they're playing is push this back. Well, until, 20 years ago, the oldest fish fossils that everybody would agree on were from the Ordovician period here. So we go to the museum and see these strachyderm, flattish fish that look like squashed slugs to me. They were about here. But about 20 years ago, they reanalyzed some Middle Cambrian animals from Canada. This is a very long time ago, about 515 million years ago. I'll just show you quickly what these were. The animal's called Picaea. It's a very celebrated animal. It's only this big. Amphioxus is about that big, too. This is not its eye. That's just a blob on the fossil on the rock. It's really going this direction. I would never study it because it lives where it's really cold. This is the Burgess Shale. These are the shales up here. Anyway, this is really, there are over 100 of these guys now known. And you can see the muscular segments, but you don't see anything else in these fossils. There's a little line here, and some people think it's a gut, and some people think it's a notochord. And that's about the end of those fossils. So they're very iffy as relatives of ancient vertebrates. And yet they became sort of officially relatives of ancient vertebrates because Stephen Jay Gould, who writes books, wrote a book called Wonderful Life. I don't know whether any of you have read that. Well, in this book, I won't tell you about the book too much, he needed to have an ancestor of the vertebrates alive in the Cambrian time. And so he took this fairly dubious fossil and he got all the probablys out of the text and he just said, this is what it is. Well, of course, he has a lot of authority, and so all the textbook writers in the last 20 years have been saying that's what it is. Well, a lot of professional paleontologists say, well, it might be. At any rate, this fossil is 515 million years old, and the bombshell that went off last year from South China was that they found fossils now that are 530 million years old. So that's 15 million years back in time, and they're also a heck of a lot better. These fossils are from the region of Kunming in South China, South Central China. In fact, south of Kunming, there's two sites. It's mountainous here, and there's mountain lakes. One is Haiku, which shows up in the names of the animals, and the other is Chenjiang, which gives its name to the whole fauna. So it's called the Chenjiang fauna. But these are shales or mudstones. And the tricky thing here is that instead of just bones or hard parts, which is what you see in museums mostly when you go to look at the fossils, like those crinoids I showed you, were all just the hard parts. These things have the soft parts preserved, which is kind of remarkable. So because of my connection with Chao Wei Li, I jumped on an airplane and I went to South China to have a look. And this is a very, I don't want to say backward because that's pejorative, it's a very interesting area because it's quite poor and it's very remote. And in fact, really, you almost never see a car. I mean, this is the main way you pull things around with water buffaloes. And people actually wore stuff like that. It wasn't because there were no tourists. In fact, it's a sensitive area in a military sense, so it's hard for me to go there because it's not very far from the Vietnamese border. To give you an idea of where it is, if you remember World War II, they had the Burma Road coming up to bring Chiang Kai-shek supplies, and this is where the Burma Road went to Kunming. And then they flew the hump later to Kunming to bring aviation fuel over the Himalayas. So it's way, way out of the way. And here I am. They had a little lab in a little town nearby, and all these boxes full of lots of incredible fossils, actually, it turned out. The first fossil I'm going to show you was found by Dr. Xu, who does not work with the people I was working with, and in fact is sort of their competitor. But the first thing that happened last December, early in December, was this thing was published in Nature magazine. And this is a fish-like, I'm sure it's a fish, it just says fish practically, from the Chenjiang fauna. It's the only fossil they found, and it's called Haiku Ichthys, which means fish from Haiku. And what you can see from back there is about what I can see from up here. There isn't much there, but it's got this very telltale muscular segmentation, you know, like your anchovy fillet. And then up front is probably a brain case, a skull that's kind of crushed and mushy. And then there are very important structures along in here, which are the gill bars. And when you see those, you've almost certainly got a vertebrate. I just redrew this so that, you know, this is all I can see in this fossil. I'm kind of running this fossil down to set up the next one to show you how little you can see in a fossil and still get a major paper. Well, the dotted lines show that everything's missing. So they don't know what the mouth looked like. They don't know whether this thing went around noshing down on its friends or whether it sucked up teeny-weeny things or what, because there's no... it's got the little skull. And then the visceral skeleton that would support, in between each gill slit, there's a hard part that's very important. And then there's a dorsal fin with some little rays in it. And that's about it. That's about it. And there's, as I said, one fossil known. So these guys have got to get their act together and get some more of those. But here's the fossil that was the most amazing. This is not Haiku Ichthys, not the fish from Haiku, but it's Haikuella, which means little animal from Haiku. And this was found by the old student from Scripps and Dr. J.Y. Chen. And as you see, this is just one piece of rock, and there's a whole bunch of animals in it. They have over 300 of these fossils by now. And this is all soft parts, really. There's nothing skeletal in here. There's something funny about the early Cambrian in that animals tended to be preserved entirely. And since that time, it hasn't happened. It's very rare now, later in the geological record, to find a fossil with soft parts in it. Mostly it's just bones. At any rate, what you see here is gill slits and the muscular segmentation and a notochord. Again, you have to look at a lot of fossils, and then you can kind of begin to reconstruct what you're thinking about. And I made this drawing just from looking at all the fossils, but here's the mouth, and here's the gill slits. And each gill slit is supported by a gill bar, and so the water comes out that way at you. There's underneath here, underneath the pharynx, is something that's equivalent to the thyroid gland, probably. It's called the endostyle in amphioxus, and it in amphioxus, and probably in this animal, it makes mucus for catching little particles. There was a tiny little tooth that always showed up here. There was a notochord, and there were little gonads. There was a heart. You could even see the heart And that's right where the amphioxus, it's very much like amphioxus in many ways. The muscular segments are here in the back third of the animal, but and there's something I thought might be an eye, and I don't, so I put a question mark. But there was a tubular nerve cord, but the brain was actually quite swollen into three parts, kind of like a vertebrate brain. And in fact, this might not even be a cephalochordate that is really in the properly put in with amphioxus. It's probably actually a very, very primitive vertebrate, because I don't want to go into the technical reasons for this, but when you see this kind of skeleton, it almost has to come from a typically vertebrate feature called the neural crest, which is a developmental bunch of cells, but that's one good reason for thinking it's a vertebrate. It's forced us to think about what vertebrates are. There are no real vertebrae in here, so you can't use that as a character. And this problem has arisen before in biology. In 1840, they'd never seen a lungfish. Okay, so they had amphibians here and they had fish here. There was a big gap. And then suddenly they found a lungfish. And it was very difficult for them to decide whether that lungfish should go on this side of the line or on that side of the line, because it had a mixture of characters. Or does it deserve its own little cubby hole where you're going to stick it all by itself? So it's the same problem. And really not enough people have discussed this animal to make the decision about exactly where to put it. But we think it might ought to be a vertebrate. But the point here is that this kind of brain that we see the beginnings of in amphioxus by two different methods is certainly there in a very, very, very early vertebrate. Okay, so the take-home messages of what I've been telling you would be, first of all, that basic research is really an important thing, and the applied sciences almost always depend on facts that were dug up out of pure, simple curiosity. You just can't decide to do something fancy unless there's a whole bunch of stuff out there in the literature that other people have done for reasons that they just didn't even explain to you, except maybe they just liked, they thought these animals were pretty. Okay, that's not being facetious at all. It's really the way things work. So, but there is some utility often to pure research, and that is the eggshell of an amphioxus illustrates a bunch of cell biology problems. For instance, how do events inside a cell in the cytoplasm translate or act as a template in a way for shaping the immediate environment, the extracellular material around that cell? And this is a problem that's common in regular development. It's common in abnormal development and cancer. So a lot of very basic cell biology is involved in looking at something like eggshell formation. The next take-home message is, one of the most exciting things personally that can happen to a scientist is when things suddenly change and you find that you're no longer studying eggshells, but you're off looking at amphioxus, or you're off in China looking at fossils. It's very, very exhilarating, especially when your big shift is still, in a sense, addressing the same problems. It doesn't have to, but if you go too far in that direction, I suppose you become a dilettante, simply chasing each thing as it comes by. But most scientists have just a few big changes during their career, and they're very important often. So another thing is, it's very gratifying when advances in two different fields or three different fields all combine to converge on the same problem you're addressing. And so people you didn't even know may do something that reinforces what you're doing, and what you've done reinforces what they're doing. And so that was another ingredient of my career. So we've seen how microanatomy and developmental genetics and paleontology all converge to give us the notion that the immediate ancestor, the invertebrate, proximate invertebrate ancestor of the vertebrates, was a fairly brainy animal with a much bigger brain than we'd ever given it credit for. Now, there's some kinds of pure research that you can absolutely not see any future practical use for, and I would say that looking at very early Cambrian fossils that have something to do with the origin of the vertebrates is in that category. I don't know whether anything practical will ever come of it. So what's the importance of that? Well, I think at a deeper philosophical level, there is an importance. And I would like to quote Thomas Huxley, the 19th century zoologist who was a friend of Darwin's, for coming up with this statement in one of his essays. He says, the question of questions for mankind, and parenthetically he means humankind, but he was politically being incorrect, the problem which underlies all others and is more deeply interesting than any other is the ascertainment of the place man occupies in nature and his relation to the universe of things. So I think that there's a very deep need for humans to try to look at their origins. And the origin questions for humans, as we look at it from this point of view, is like a bunch of Russian dolls. So the Russian dolls are various origin questions. So the outer doll is the origin of the universe. And the next doll is the origin of the solar system. The next doll, the Earth. The next doll, say, the ocean. The next doll, life on Earth. The next doll, multicellular life. The next doll, and on up. And on the path to humans comes a doll. And this is the question of the origin of the vertebrates. The doll inside of that doll is a little teeny doll, and that's the origin of hominids. So that's why every little bone that they find in the old Ouvai Gorge turns into a major paper in Nature, whether it deserves to or not. Again, it's a human way of looking at things. And if you want to think of it this way, if you go to a major natural history museum, you'll walk through hall after hall of the most beautiful vertebrate fossils you've ever seen. And the invertebrate fossils, which are just as beautiful, are usually filling half a room somewhere. Okay, so it's just the way we are. I mean, we want to know about our origins. So I think that's kind of one of the sort of deeply satisfying things about tackling questions like that. Well, this isn't completely the end, because I want to thank somebody for getting me into talking to you today, and that's Debbie Marsley. What is her title now? Somebody help me. Okay, so she works at the aquarium here, and she happens to be a fellow crinoid aficionado of mine. In fact, she wrote her thesis on it, and here we are. And I won't tell you how many years ago this was, because Debbie looks exactly the same now. I don't. And I don't want to give away her age, but this was a fair way back. I don't even think she's carrying my diving equipment. I think that's hers, so please. But anyway, we're arriving in Australia to go diving on the Great Barrier Reef. I'll just show you a couple more slides of Debbie, because I promised her I would. Next one. Next. Oh. Yeah, she was my chauffeur at Lizard Island. This is a lovely island about 250 miles away from Cairns, Australia. You have to fly up there and take everything you're going to eat and drink with you in this one-engine plane. And this was I think there were only three wheeled vehicles on the island. That was one of them, the Land Rover. And Debbie was also the official photographer for the expedition. Here she is photographing a thing that says Drive Carefully Wildlife. There's a picture of a kangaroo. And that's not a joke in Australia. Those things hop out in front of your car, and they can just destroy a car. They're huge. So unless you have big bars on the front of your car, you have to drive pretty slowly. And the last thing I'll show is, this is, does show it's the end, but this is actually what the sunset looked like every night from my front porch. Debbie and I had a little house here with a front porch that overlooked the boats that we would go out for, to catch the crinoids in every day. And every night was a different sunset. So that's another reason to be a marine biologist. So with that, I'll say that's the end. And if you have any questions, please ask.
You mentioned the scientists found the DNA in 1875.
Mm-hmm. No, even earlier. He published in 1871, and he actually had done the work in 1868, so it was just shortly after the Civil War. And it's funny, because at that time, he was a physician. He was not a PhD, he had an MD. And he was working at a time when they still bled you. You know, I mean, it was becoming obvious to the more advanced medical people that there was something really wrong with bleeding people and that sort of thing. But he was way ahead of his time. And he used things like, he made his own pancreatic enzyme, digestive enzymes from pepsin, from hogs. He had to do everything from scratch. He digested all the proteins away. He removed all the lipids. He ended up extracting the DNA from, this is pretty awful, pus cells from bandages that they got at the hospital, got the nuclei out, and he found this enormous molecule that had an unusually high amount of phosphorus in it. And in fact, it was later that it was even a decade later that his one of his students christened it nucleic acid, actually. But it was an incredible feat at the time. I mean, the man was a brilliant chemist.
Yeah. How does that tie in with what they've done back on the East Coast there with the, it's just recently in the newspapers there, something with the computer setting and analyzing the DNA codes?
Well, I mean, they cracked the DNA code when I was in graduate school so they could figure out what three nucleotides translated into which amino acid. Right now what they're doing is something called genomics or informatics, where they're able to take almost all of the messages out of a given cell and make a microchip out of it and then analyze it with a computer and tell, really, there are hundreds of genes active at any one time, and they're able to put in serial order when these genes are going on and turning off, and this gives you hints about how they interact with each other. So it's suddenly a huge quantum jump. I mean, I'm talking about, in my work here, single genes that work in networks. It's like a food web in the ocean. I mean, the ocean contains things that eat other things, and really, the whole ocean is one huge interconnected web, because not one animal doesn't just eat one kind of animal. Usually, it's a bunch, and it's eaten by a bunch. So you get this cat's cradle, messy cat's cradle of reactions. That's the way the genes are working. They're turning each other on and off, and they're doing stuff over here, and they're feeding back on that thing. And so the way to get to how it's child's play to look at one at a time turning on and off, but it's the big jump now is that they're able to look at thousands of genes in one cell turning on and off. It's got to show something. It's so new they don't even know what the problem is. Let's see, anything else? Okay. I hope that wasn't too many. I've never given a talk that covered too much stuff before like this, but I jumped, you know, through a whole bunch of things. And that's, I made this simple. I mean, I've done a whole lot of other things in my career. It wasn't just eggshells, but so I've been busy. Yeah. But it's very nice to work with your wife, for example. I mean, you know, it means that we can travel together to nice places and do stuff like that. So it's a very gratifying career. And the animals couldn't have cooperated more. I mean, none of them lived, you know, up in the snows of Canada like those other ones. But that might have been a little deliberate. I'm not sure.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.